Hello, everyone. My name is Michael McConnell. I'm a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and I want to welcome you to Hoover Capital Conversations. The Hoover Institution is a preeminent research center whose mission is dedicated to the principles of individual, economic, and political freedom, private enterprise, and limited representative government. The Capital Conversation series brings Hoover Fellows together with policymakers for informed, in-depth discussions examining some of our nation's most vexing policy issues. By bringing together the key players in policy development and policy execution, we hope to enrich the landscape of ideas, ask bold questions, and seek powerful solutions to improve people's lives. Now, today it's my special pleasure to be talking to Senator Mike Lee, discussing executive power under the U.S. Constitution. He was elected in 2010 as Utah's 16th senator. Prior to becoming a senator, he served as a law clerk for the U.S. District Court for the District of Utah and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. He currently serves in the following committees: the Joint Economic Committee as ranking member, Commerce, Science, and Transportation, Energy and Natural Resources, Judiciary, and the Senate Special Committee on Aging. So he's a busy guy. But what I want to recall, because I find this so refreshing, is that when he began running for the Senate back in 2010 against an incumbent senator of long standing, he used an unusual technique. He went around to the small towns of Utah and the larger, and those more substantial cities, and talked to groups about the U.S. Constitution, not about politics and policy and so forth, but about, he actually gave talks to them about the U.S. Constitution itself, and used the Federalist Papers and so forth. And that caught fire, and suddenly he became, as the kids say, you know, it went viral, and the rest is history. And he's now one of the more thoughtful senators in the United States. So I welcome Senator Lee. I should say one other personal note here. He got his taste for things constitutional from his father, former Solicitor General Rex Lee, who was the chief lawyer for the United States government in the Supreme Court under early years of President Reagan, where I had the honor to be Solicitor General Lee's assistant. So I was very close to Senator Lee's father, and still regard him as one of the great American lawyers of all time. So welcome to his son and my friend, Mike Lee.
Thank you so much, Judge McConnell. It's a pleasure to be with you. You were always one of my very favorite judges to argue in front of when you were on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit. And you're someone whose legal and constitutional opinions I value greatly and always look to and admire. I'm also a big fan of your new book, The President Who Would Not Be King. This is a book that I'm absolutely loving and something that every American needs to read.
Happy to hear that. That makes me feel very proud. And that actually leads to our conversation today. There are so many different things we could be talking about, but we decided that we will be talking about the presidency at this particular juncture in our history. And as most people are aware, the presidency is not exactly what the framers envisioned. My book talks a lot about that issue, but it's particularly troubling because every time a different party takes over in the White House, everyone seems to flip sides. So you really need a scorecard to know. So everybody who was all worried about the extent of executive power under President Trump is now all for it, and to an alarming extent, the other way around. I like to think that Senator Lee is actually somebody who has been sticking to the same principles across party lines, and that's important because our Constitution wasn't written for Republicans or Democrats. It was written to restrain power for everyone. He has been a leader in what they call the Article One Project, which is about revitalizing the powers of Congress. So, Senator Leake, tell us a little bit about your understanding of the relationship between revitalizing Congress and the overweening powers of the president.
They really are two sides of the same coin. Over the last 85 years or so, you've seen a trend, and this is a trend created by both political parties. Under the leadership of Senate's Houses of Representatives and White Houses of every conceivable partisan combination, you've seen significant transfers of power, kind of in two stages. First is power is transferred from the people, where it's supposed to be exercised at the state and local level, to Washington, D.C. And then within Washington, D.C., it's been handed over from the people's elected lawmakers to unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats, or in some cases, to the president himself. It's been disastrous. And while not a lot of people focus on the causal relationship between the first step and the second, I think it's definitely there. In other words, the Constitution was sort of built on these twin structural protections. Before we even get to the Bill of Rights, to the thou shalt nots of the Constitution, we have these structural protections that are nonpartisan, not really even ideological, but they are the vertical protection of federalism that says that most of the power is supposed to remain close to the people at the state and local level within states and political subdivisions thereof. Only a few powers, those enumerated in the Constitution as being federal, and those necessary and proper to those powers are to be exercised at the federal level. And then there's the horizontal protection, the separation of powers that makes a legislative branch and an executive branch and a judicial branch. When we started drifting from one, meaning federalism, we inevitably created a sequence of events that would culminate and have continued to culminate in the transfer of power from legislative branch over to the executive branch. In other words, once inundated with vast new powers, starting as I see it, I trace it more or less back to April 12, 1937, when the Supreme Court decided a case called NLRB versus Jones and Laughlin Steele. It reinterpreted the Commerce Clause more broadly to give Congress more power. This culminated in the line of decisions known as Wickard v. Filburn, where Roscoe Filburn grew too much wheat. He defended himself by saying, that wheat didn't even enter interstate commerce because I used the wheat by which I exceeded the federal limit to feed my family and my farm animals and to use the remainder as seed for the next season. The Supreme Court said it didn't matter whether it was produced for economic purposes or home use. It still had an economic impact that was substantial. So at that moment, Congress all of a sudden found itself in charge of purely local intrastate activities while economic in nature, were still local. Labor, manufacturing, agriculture, mining were suddenly federal. In order to keep up with this power and all the accountability with it, Congress started delegating out that power to the executive branch. It's a slight oversimplification, but in some ways the way this happens is that Congress will pass a law saying, we hereby declare that we shall have good law in area X, and we hereby delegate to commission or department Y, or to the president himself, the power to make and interpret and enforce good laws in area X. This has made the president, the executive branch as a whole, and the president in particular, it's turned into an imperial presidency of sorts. It's been used as a tool for members of Congress to facilitate their quest toward perpetual reelection by helping them avoid difficult line-drawing questions that a lawmaker inevitably faces. It's resulted in the excessive accumulation of power in the hands of the few. It has gored Republican and Democratic oxen alike. It is ultimately bad for the people, and it is a nonpartisan and bipartisan issue at once.
Well, when political decisions are being handled in these commissions and agencies and so forth, how does the people's will get translated into government action?
It doesn't, and that's one of the problems with it. One of the features, in my view, and I believe in the view of the founders. I'm always hesitant to speak for them. They're not here to defend themselves, but I believe that the way they wrote the Constitution and the things they said at the time suggest that they believed that the most dangerous branch of the three was the legislative branch. At least the most dangerous power is the legislative power. And for that reason, they entrusted it only to that branch of government that's most accountable to the people at the most regular intervals. When you place an intermediate step in between there, the lawmaking power is then given to someone else, especially if that someone else is not himself or herself elected or accountable to the people at the same intervals or at any interval at all, as is the case with most executive branch bureaucrats, then the people are taken completely outside the process. And then it's not only anti-constitutional, but it becomes fundamentally anti-democratic.
Well, we've seen this under presidents of both parties, right? I think clear cases where, you know, the president wants a particular policy and Congress will not go along with it, and then the president does it anyway. I think, for example, President Obama, repeatedly tried to get a Dreamer legislation through Congress that would have to do with immigration, removal of immigration restrictions for the children of illegal migrants into the country. And, you know, Congress wouldn't go along. And then after an election, he simply did this by executive order. Or, you know, President Trump came to Congress a number of times wanting to get money for his huge, beautiful wall on the border with Mexico. And Congress said, no, we're not going to go along with that. And he decided he would build it, you know, using, you know, funds from here and there and tucked into his back pocket anyway. Why doesn't Congress stand up for its powers? I mean, those are fundamental powers vested in Congress, not in the president. Why doesn't Congress stand up for itself?
Congress doesn't stand up for itself because, this, Judge McConnell, this is a feature, not a bug, from the subjective viewpoint of many members of Congress. They're not inclined to say that publicly. Many of them might not even articulate that concept to themselves. But at the end of the day, it works for many members of Congress to be able to have someone else to demagogue and someone else to blame, to be able to embrace a president whose views they agree with and eschew and condemn and belittle a president whose views they disagree with. Now, it's interesting you mentioned those two examples. I've had this very argument with President Obama and with President Trump on the very two topics that you're describing there. I disagreed with both of them on both of those issues. There was nothing about the fact that President Trump belonged to my political party that caused me to see that one differently. I believe that the National Emergencies Act invoked by President Trump in the case of the border wall is itself so broad as to be staggering. Now, interestingly enough, the National Emergencies Act is so broad, it might well properly be read to give him what he had the power to do there. I still voted against him on it, and he was unhappy with me, and many of his supporters were unhappy with me about that. But as I explained to him and to the voters in Utah and anyone else who would listen, the delegation to the presidency in that instance was so broad, I think it's bad. And I can't look at a situation in which Congress was specifically asked to appropriate a large sum of money, declined to do so, refused to do so, in any act of Congress that gives the president the power to come along afterwards and say, I disagree with that. I'm going to reappropriate already appropriated funds devoted to another purpose, to this purpose. That's not right. Now, that caused me a fair amount of condemnation and scorn within my own political party, just as my opposition to President Obama's actions that you mentioned had then too. But I think that it's part of the oath that we take as members of Congress to protect the Constitution that compels us to do that, regardless of what our political views are. And there's no clause providing an out where you happen to agree or disagree with a particular policy position of a president. That doesn't change the constitutional mandate in question.
So are there Democratic senators and members of the House who will take the same position vis-a-vis President Biden that you sometimes did with Trump?
Yeah, yes. The short answer is I think so. Now, we're still early enough in the Biden administration that it's difficult to predict exactly who will land where. But I've had some allies on these issues over the years. And it breaks down differently depending on the issue set in question. One of the areas where this manifests itself and where I've been sort of a broken record repeating this over and over again is in war powers. In Federalist 69, Alexander Hamilton explains that there was a good reason why we didn't follow the English model and leave the power to go to war with the executive. You know, the king had that power. We went in a different direction, saying that has to belong to Congress. Why? Well, because going to war is fraught with moral, economic, and other kinds of peril, so much so that you really need it to be vested only in the branch of government most accountable to the people at the most regular intervals. I've had a number of allies on this, bipartisan allies over the years, going back to the Obama administration. I think they will continue to be allies there. Bernie Sanders and I don't always agree on everything. You know, he's identified himself as a socialist. He's from Vermont. I'm not known by either of those titles, but he and I both agree the war power is sacred. It shouldn't be thrown around lightly. It shouldn't be assumed, and it shouldn't be delegated off to the executive branch. So he and I and Chris Murphy and Tim Kaine and a number of others have teamed up over the years to push back on unconstitutional, unauthorized wars, including the fact that we've been involved in a civil war in Yemen for the last 6 years without any authorization for the use of military force or declaration of war. That's not okay. That's one of the areas where we've got some bipartisan agreement.
Yes, and in fact, majorities of both houses, when the Republicans still controlled the Senate, both houses voted to discontinue the war in Yemen. President Trump vetoed that bill and just, you know, kept going.
We tried to override his veto. This, by the way, was the first successful invocation of the War Powers Resolution of 1973 in its entire history, the Lee Sanders Amendment to get us out of that war. I had a lot of Republicans, including in Congress and at the White House, mad at me over that one. But we're absolutely on the side of the angels there. Now, fortunately, it looks like President Biden's going to get us out of that war, and that's a good thing.
I read in the papers that there is an effort to repeal the two. Actually, there are more than two. I didn't realize that one goes. There's another one that goes back to 1957, authorizations for the use of military force in the Middle East that are open-ended and completely obsolete, and have been used to justify military interventions in matters that have absolutely nothing to do with their original, post 9/11 purposes. What do you think is? I'm curious both what you think is going to happen, but also, will this be a point of bipartisanship, or is this going to be one more thing where the parties end up at loggerheads with each other?
You know, I think there is a growing bipartisan consensus on this one. People are tired of wars that last for decades. You know, I have a daughter who was an infant when 9/11 happened, only a few months old. She's halfway through college now. And these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have been going on her entire lifetime. this has helped us produce a generation of Americans that sees enough is enough, and that we've got to get out of this practice. But you're right. We've got these open-ended, pre-existing authorizations for the use of military force that have piled up. And that coupled with some very crafty lawyering from Department of Defense and other lawyers within the executive branch of government and, you know, in Republican and Democratic administrations alike, has led to an almost military nihilism when it comes to any limits on that power. They'll vacillate between, on the one hand, saying this isn't war, this isn't an armed conflict, and therefore doesn't require any authorization for the use of military force. And on the other hand, saying that this or that authorization for the use of military force from however many decades ago justifies it, even when the countries aren't named, because they'll identify some sequence of logical connections that in their mind somehow justifies it. People aren't buying it anymore, and that's why I think we're going to win.
The war in Libya is a particularly clear example of that. I remember reading the Department of Justice opinion justifying that war, which was not authorized by Congress. President Obama actually spent months negotiating with the Europeans over whether they thought he should go, but he didn't bother going to the body that the Constitution says that he should have. And the opinion came down. I still remember sitting there, it was on April 1st that it came down. As I read it, I thought, what an appropriate date for this, because it actually pays no attention whatsoever to the history or meaning of the Constitution. And it was all like citing precedents from the last 20 or 30 years. And every time a president starts a new war without going to Congress, they just add that as a new precedent and, you know, more justification for the next one. It's not just war, there's foreign policy in general. I'm curious what your view is on the Iranian, they call it
JCPOA.
The JCPOA. They call it that instead of a treaty, but it sure does look like a treaty because it commits the United States to not enforcing various laws passed by Congress that impose sanctions on Iran in exchange for future promises from Iran. That looks an awful lot like a treaty. Why didn't that have to go to the Senate for treaty ratification?
It did. It should have, but they decided not to do it. At the time, I was serving on the Senate Armed Services Committee, and then Secretary of State John Kerry came to testify about the JCPOA. I asked him that very question. Why haven't you submitted this as a treaty? Because it fits, as far as I can tell, all of the hallmark characteristics of a treaty. And far from being just a mere policy statement or an aspirational document, this thing, as you point out, materially altered the legal obligations of the United States relative to other nations and also relative to our own system of laws, our own laws passed by Congress. So that's the kind of thing that really shouldn't take effect as an international agreement without ratification by the Senate, two-thirds of the Senate are ratifying it. So I asked him that very question. His response was stunning. He said, well, you know, this involves more parties than just the United States and Iran. It involves other countries too. And in addition to that, it also involves other entities that are not sovereign nations, but that are organizations. As it just so happened, I had the Department of the State Department's own definition of treaty in front of me from the State Department's own website. And I read it to him, and it clearly encompassed everything he had just described. There's nothing about the fact that it involved multiple countries or non-sovereign organizations that were parties to it that took it out of the definition of a treaty. In fact, their definition expressly encompassed those things. So he backed off of that and later said, well, I think we were afraid that Congress wouldn't ratify it. Well, that's the whole point. if you're afraid they wouldn't ratify, you can't just for that reason assume that it has been ratified or treat it as if it were a treaty, because it's not. It's part of how messed up this this dynamic is. And I would add to that, it's also part of how our presidential politics have become so emotionally charged. They were never intended to be this emotionally charged, never would be this emotionally charged. They might be intense in other ways. But if we were following the Constitution and we were allowing for the power to be distributed in the manner in which the Constitution already requires, setting aside what the founding fathers subjectively intended or how they imagined it to work or how it previously worked, just if you follow the words as they still read today, according to their common meaning, even their common meaning today, you wouldn't have such an emotional fervor behind it, because power would be distributed and we would no longer be looking to the presidency as if it were a king. Reminds me from the Old Testament of the words of 1 Samuel chapter 8, talking about the problems of having a king. We don't want those problems. We're not supposed to have them in the United States. That's why we've got a constitution. But we need to follow it for it to work.
Well, we've been talking about war and foreign affairs, but there's also a huge domestic side of all of this. We can't even scratch the surface of it. But since you're the ranking member of the Joint Economic Committee, I wanted to hear your thoughts about the budget situation. My copy of the Constitution says, actually, in two different places, it couldn't be more emphatic, that Congress has control over appropriations, what we call the power of the purse. And yet all of this now seems to be driven by presidential authority. How does our budget situation fit, in your view, with the constitutional vision?
Well, it certainly departs from it in many material ways. The money that the federal government itself spends still does have to be appropriated by Congress, and it is, but when Congress acts as if it were almost an afterthought, and when Congress will, in many cases, particularly where both houses of Congress are under the control of the same political party as the president, sometimes you'll have the muscles of Congress start to atrophy, and where there will be an almost blind deference and a delay, a deliberate, willful delay to act on anything or to decide appropriations questions unless or until such time as the president directs. That's certainly not how it's supposed to work. There are a lot of other things that are related to budget type issues, including the fact that the Federal Reserve has as much influence as it does, is effectively the, in many ways, the financier of the federal government. Not directly, but indirectly, it ends up having many of those impacts. Those were all things that certainly would have surprised the founding fathers. And with respect to this issue of separation of powers generally, it's one thing that I think James Madison didn't properly foresee. In many ways, Madison was prescient in his ability to foresee the various pitfalls and advantages of our constitutional system. He did believe that power would be made to counteract power, and that the three branches would have a way of sort of balancing each other out. And it's not that all three branches are equal in the sense that they're identical. They really are different. Like I say, the legislative power, I think, is the most dangerous, especially as the way they set it up. But his point was that you're not going to see too much of an accretion of power in one branch at the expense of the other two, because the other two will see that happening and respond. I think the part he didn't foresee was the rise of the career politician who, in pursuit of perpetual reelection, would be inclined to say, yeah, I know the executive branch is exercising too much power, and I know we're being asked to delegate more of that power here, but I'm willing to do that because it'll make it easier for me to get reelected. That's a problem, and it's one that we've got to confront.
I was about to start throwing you some questions that we've gotten from the audience. And interestingly, what you've just been addressing is the first question from an audience member named Brian, who writes, the nation's founders believe that Congress would jealously guard its constitutional powers, but it is arguably allowed or even encouraged over many years the executive branch to progressively take more power. And then here's the now he gets to the heart of it. Senator Lee, you're going to be on the hot seat here for the question, which is, how can Congress best reassert itself as a meaningful check on executive power?
You know, first and foremost, when these things come to the attention of members of the public, when voters start to express concern about how much power we have delegated away, that will start to make a difference. These are, as I sometimes explain, it's an unfortunate reality that we don't have large grassroots political movements that spring up spontaneously calling for a restoration of federalism and separation of powers. I wish that there were. If there ever is one, I'm going to definitely be part of that political party. In the absence of that, it can be very helpful for people to just take bite-sized attempts to restore some of these things. Bite-sized reforms, for example, in the area of regulatory policy. When the modern administrative regulatory system was sort of started to develop under FDR, James Landis, a Harvard law professor who was part of FDR's brain trust, who helped design that system, explained to President Roosevelt that as a matter of proper form, what we would today call major rules, meaning significant regulations put out by an executive branch agency, before they could take effect, they really should be passed into law by Congress. FDR didn't quite get to that part of it. He never got that part of it done. Congress adopted a cheap imitation of that, known as the legislative veto, where Congress would outsource a certain type of rulemaking, but then say if agency or commission or department X, Y, or Z makes a regulation we don't like, then a simple concurrent resolution of Congress can undo it. Those kinds of measures, legislative vetoes, we call them, gained popularity until we had many hundreds of them, until the Supreme Court concluded that they were unconstitutional, that they violated Article 1, Section 7's presentment clause in 1983 in a case called INS v. Chadha. At that point, many Americans believed that Congress would stop this much delegation of power. They would stop delegating the lawmaking power to executive branch agencies, but it didn't happen. It only got worse. There are legislative proposals designed to deal with some of these issues. One is called the RAINS Act. It's an acronym that stands for Regulations from the Executive in Need of Scrutiny. It would say that for any major rule, can't take effect until both houses of Congress have affirmatively enacted it into law, and it's been submitted to the president for signature or veto. This is a way of restoring some of the benefits of the legislative veto, but in a way that's not unconstitutional under INS v. Chadha. I've got a similar bill to do for trade policy what the RAINS Act would do for regulatory policy in the form of a bill called the Global Trade Accountability Act. It identifies a dozen or so areas where since the late 20s and early 30s, Congress has delegated to the president or to other executive branch offices the power to start a trade war. I don't think those should be self-executing. They ought to require an affirmative act of Congress submitted to the president for signature or veto. I know that it's hard to imagine a world in which these legislative proposals are part of the vernacular of everyday Americans. I refuse to believe that they can't be, however, because the American people aren't dumb. They know something's wrong, And little by little, I think efforts like these are going to gain momentum.
Unfortunately, our time is up, but I'd like to just point out to our audience something that I find really refreshing and interesting, which is we've been, Senator Lee and I have been talking about the Constitution and how to restore some of the guardrails and divisions of power that the Constitution provides for. But did you notice what he did not say? He did not say take it to the Supreme Court, right? Senator Lee believes, I'm interpreting from that, must believe that our representative government is responsible for enforcing the United States Constitution as the courts, maybe even in some ways more so. And it's good to hear that, because I think one of the big problems is we've tended to outsource constitutionalism to the Supreme Court, and it doesn't belong just to the Supreme Court. It belongs also to the Senate and the House of Representatives, and even to we the people. So with that, thank you very much for a very engaging discussion, Senator Lee, and thank all of you for joining us today. I hope you'll tune back in on April 15th for a discussion with Hoover Fellow Caroline Hoxby, with State Education Commissioners Michael Johnson and Richard Corcoran. So thank you for your attendance and attention.